I'd like to welcome you to today's Kluwen Internet Seminar on Incremental Composite Sampling Designs for Surface Soil Analyses. This is Module 4 of 4, so the last in a four-part series on ICS. My name is Jean Ballant, and I work here in the Technology Innovation and Field Services Division at EPA, and I'll be helping to moderate today's session. As a reminder, with all of the seminars in this series and everything we do on Kluwen, individual participants will be manually guided through materials via either the phone or online audio stream by our presenters. So you'll need to be sure to have a copy of the presentation materials open in front of you today. If you haven't either downloaded them or clicked the button Go to Seminar from the seminar homepage, you want to be sure to follow an email link or one of the calendar reminders we sent out to go to the seminar homepage and either click the button that says Go to Seminar to open them up in a web browser window or download a copy of the presentation materials as PowerPoint or PDF. We were starting on the title slide, which is slide number 1. I'm going to ask everybody to move along to slide number 2, which is our housekeeping slide, and I'll cover some basic reminders before we kick off the technical presentation. I've globally muted all of the phone lines. We do have a very large audience, so just to make things easier, everyone has been placed on mute. We will have designated breaks for Q&A, and at that time, if you're on the phones, I'll remind you how you can take yourself off of mute and you can ask your question. But until then, we would ask that you keep the call simply muted and don't put the call on hold. There could be background music or commercials that could be disruptive. So again, please sit tight on the global mute, and I'll provide instructions on how to unmute when we get to the points for Q&A. Those of you that are streaming audio online, you won't be able to ask questions out loud, but you can take advantage of some of the icons that appear at the top of your slides. If you look at the orange buttons at the top, you'll see arrows pointing to the left and right, which will help you move through the slides. So again, single arrow to the right will move you forward one slide. The single arrow to the left will move you backwards one slide. The question mark icon, as long as your pop-up blockers have been disabled, will open up a new window if you click on it so you can type up your comment or question. And in fact, I would encourage you to type up comments and questions as soon as they occur to you. That way, when we get to the designated breaks for Q&A, I'll have a nice queue of questions already prepared and submitted, and I'll be able to ask them out loud on your behalf to the presenters so that they can answer them. Again, our presenters will be indicating as they move through the materials. If you're just joining us, I'm on slide number 2. This session, just like all of the previous parts of the seminar, will be recorded and will be archived for access. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to get the archive ready and posted. We do have the first part up already because there was an audio problem for some participants, so we made sure to get that one up early. The other 3 pieces have not yet been posted, but they will be posted again in the next 1 to 2 weeks. You will automatically receive an email from me as soon as the archive is available, and you'll be welcome to forward that on to anyone that you see fit. I think that's the end of the set of reminders I have for everybody. So I'm going to move on to slide number 3, and I'm going to pass things over to our presenters. Today's presentation is, again, the last of the series, and it will present 2 case studies. One case study is from a PCB cleanup project that was performed at the Department of Energy's Paducah Uranium Enrichment Facility, and the second will review an experimental study examining the performance of incremental sampling on a former shooting range. Today's presenters are Dina Crumbling from EPA's Superfund program and Robert Johnson from Argonne National Laboratory. And again, on slide number 3, I'll turn it over.
Go on to slide number 4. This is Dina Crumbling. For those who haven't been on the seminar before, today's agenda is, as Jean mentioned, a case study that was done at the Department of Energy's Paducah facility. Then we'll have a 10-minute Q&A after that case study. And then we'll have a second case study which reports out an experimental project. And we'll have a 10-minute question and answer period after that. Then we'll cover some resources that are in addition to the ones that are listed on the resources page for this seminar. And then we'll have a final Q&A covering the entire 4-part series as the audience wishes, and we'll do that for about 20 minutes. Next slide, slide 5. Your instructors, Bob Johnson at Argonne National Lab will present the Paducah case study, and I will present the experimental case study. Next slide, 6. And I'll turn it over to Bob.
All right. Thank you, Dina. I'm going to be presenting the first case study for the day, and it has to do with a project conducted down at the Paducah site. If you go to slide number 7, please. Paducah hosts the nation's only commercially operational uranium enrichment facility. It's a large facility that dates back to World War II. It was instrumental in the bombs program here in the U.S. and in that process. Originally enriching uranium for bomb-making purposes, but then after that enriching uranium for nuclear power plants. The site is an unusual site in that it draws an enormous amount of electrical power. And if you were to visit the facility, you would see high-tension power lines coming in from all directions, terminating at transformer boxes surrounding the facility. And as I'm sure most people on the phone know, old power transformers use PCB fluids, oils inside them, and consequently the site has a significant PCB issue associated with soils surrounding the facility, primarily because of maintenance activities that went on and disposal activities that went on with the various power transformers that were in use at the site. The site also has a significant amount of uranium contamination in soils and sediments. And the reason for that is that the site processed uranium and enriched uranium for a long period of time. And, of course, standards back in the 40s and 50s were not the same as standards today. And consequently, like a lot of facilities, federal facilities in operation at the time, there was some significant environmental contamination that took place. So there were historical releases of PCBs and uranium to the environment. The site is drained by a series of ditches that come out from the center of the site like spokes on a wheel and terminate in streams that drain the area. And those ditches were used for a variety of purposes, drainage being the primary one. But one of the consequences was that releases to the environment were often captured by the ditches and carried down and contaminated sediments both in the ditches themselves and in the streams that they then fed. To maintain drainage, what the site would do is periodically it would go with a backhoe down the ditches and remove sediments and place them along the sides of the ditches where in piles, and those piles would, you know, because of other activity, get dispersed over time. And as it turns out, those piles were contaminated with uranium and PCBs, and that's causing a concern today. So our concern are PCBs and uranium contamination in soils where dredge materials were placed from these streams and drainage ditches. And the general assumption is that in this setting, if you find uranium, you're likely to find PCBs or vice versa because of the release mechanisms and the kind of the integrating nature of streams and ditches in this kind of environment. Next slide, please. Slide 8. So our study area of concern is about 1 acre in size, and you see an aerial photograph of it here. The red line denotes the 1 acre that we're focused on. From the left, you'll see a faint blue line coming in. That's one of the ditches coming off-site, and it links up with a stream, the blue line crossing from west to east across the bottom of the photograph. The concern, again, is sediments that may have been dredged from that ditch and its stream and then placed along the banks. And those soils were probably placed 20 or 30 years ago, and you can see there are trees that are there that have grown up. They're about at the same vintage. So if you were to walk that area now, you wouldn't necessarily see a lot of visible evidence of those dredging activities on those soil piles. Next slide, please. Slide 9. Because this is a site that has radioactive material contamination, uranium is slightly radioactive, something called MARSIM applies. And MARSIM stands for the Multi-Agency Radiation Survey and Site Investigation Manual. It's a multi-agency document that describes how sampling should take place to verify compliance with cleanup requirements if you have radionuclide contamination. The NRC, US EPA, the Department of Energy, the Department of Defense all collaborated on producing this document. And it actually provides a fairly robust framework in which to do sampling for this purpose. Within MARSIM, there is an assumption that there are two cleanup criteria that one is going to apply. One is a wide area average criteria that would be applied to exposure units, similar to what we've been talking about over the last several sessions. In other words, an average criteria that we have to meet across an exposure area. And then a second, BISM has a hotspot concept. And again, you know, in the risk assessment world, there's a lot of debate about whether hotspot really had meaning or not from a risk perspective. But when we're talking about radionuclides, in fact, Marston's very explicit. There is such a thing as a hotspot that you have to be concerned about, and Marston provides definitions of that. So we have those two criteria in play that we have to demonstrate compliance with. And the table at the bottom of this slide shows what those criteria are for our two contaminants of concern, uranium and total PCBs. On average, we have to meet 10 ppm for uranium over an exposure unit and 3.6 ppm for total PCBs. Our hotspot criteria is 90 ppm for uranium and 33 ppm for total PCBs. And again, we need to have a complete definition of what a hotspot is if we're going to design a sampling program to verify that it doesn't exist. And in this particular case, the hotspot definition was 25 square meters. So 5 meters by 5 meters in size. That's what we're concerned about from a hotspot perspective. Next slide, please. Slide 10. If one is pursuing uranium in the environment, and particularly in soils, one has a couple of analytical options to use. Background conditions for uranium in soils, around 3 ppm, parts per million. One can go after uranium with something called a gamma walkover survey, or a gamma walkover scan. I'm going to show you some photos of that here in just a moment, in subsequent slides. It's a very cheap way of collecting data. It's qualitative in nature, but it's spatially comprehensive. It can provide a complete assessment of the contamination status of surface soils anyway that are scanned or surveyed. A second option is to go after uranium with an XRF, X-ray fluorescence. X-ray fluorescence, for most people, they probably think of lead or chromium or maybe arsenic, and they probably don't think of uranium. But it turns out an XRF is really, in some ways, ideally suited for uranium. Uranium, of course, is a metal. From an XRF perspective, it's not subject to interference, so it's readily measurable and at fairly low detection levels. So it's really a quantitative, if done right, XRF can be a quantitative analytical technique for uranium, and we can get down to around 10 ppm with fairly short readings, and an XRF can be brought to the field, and it's relatively cheap to use. The third way we can go after uranium is something called alpha spectroscopy. That's in a standard laboratory. It's considered definitive, kind of the gold standard. It's very expensive, and of course there's a typical lab turnaround of 21 days, 28 days. That one will have to wait to get the results back. Those are our options for uranium. In the case of total PCBs, of course, assumption here is they're not in background. So if we can measure PCBs in the soils, then that's evidence of impacts. We could go after them with test kits. It's semi-quantitative. We can do it in the field, get relatively rapid turnaround times, detection limits that are around perhaps a half ppm, and relatively cheap to do, as opposed to going to an off-site technique such as a GC, which we would consider to be more definitive in nature, but obviously more expensive and with an associated turnaround time that one would typically associate with an off-site laboratory. Next slide, please. Slide 11. So here's an example of a man, a gentleman, doing a gamma walkover survey. And he has, holding in his hand, he has a detector, a gamma detector, that's facing the ground. And you can almost think of it as a camera, except it's not taking pictures of light, it's taking pictures of gamma rays coming off the soil surface. And it's doing it very quickly. It's taking a picture about once every second. And if this gentleman's walking at a slow, even pace, that equates to about 1 square meter per reading. So if you think of sample support, which we talked about earlier, in earlier presentations, the sample support for one of these readings is about a square meter down to a depth of about 6 inches. You can see about the top 6 inches of soil. On his back, he has a GPS unit that this particular device is tied to that logs the data coming off the sensor and stamps it with coordinates so that one can map the data after the walkover is done. And you see the result to the right in that map. And that map, if you look at it closely, you can actually see the lines he's walking. And if you were to really zoom in on the map, you'd see the individual points that were generated by this gamma walkover survey. Each of those points is color-coded by the level of gross activity, gamma activity that's coming off the soil surface. That ranges from green, which is round background, through yellow, which is indications of impacts, up through oranges, and then into red. And this is an interesting site. This is a result of actually doing the walkover for this acre, and there are about 20,000 measurements here. So it's very spatially comprehensive. You see a classic hotspot pop up, and it's that violet area that's circled in red, where we obviously have a fairly high concentration of uranium in a very localized spot, probably where a soil pile was placed some 20 or 30 years ago. So what the Galley Walkover Survey data is doing for us here is it's telling us right off the bat that we likely have a hot spot at this site. And the reason that's interesting is because I'm going to be showing you some slides subsequent to this that illustrate how one would go after this hot spot using incremental sampling, composite searching approach. And we have the benefit here from our Gamma Walkover Survey of actually knowing that a hotspot effect exists. And so we can see exactly how well our discrete sampling or our composite sampling does in identifying the presence of that hotspot. One other statement about this particular slide. If my only problem here was uranium, and that was it, in superficial soils, I wouldn't bother with composite sampling for this site. Because I have a technique that is fairly definitive in terms of the presence and absence, or presence or absence of uranium at levels of concern. And I probably could base my decisions for this particular site on this instrument's data alone, perhaps combined, maybe perhaps supported with XRF readings. We have another problem here, though, and that's PCBs. I can't see PCBs. I don't have the equivalent of anything like a gamma walkover survey for PCBs. So I'm going to have to go after those with discrete samples, or composite samples in this particular case, as I'm going to show you. Next slide, please. Slide 12. So we take that 1 acre unit and we break it into exposure. We take that 1 acre area and we break it into exposure units. And we define three of them for this study. The total area is about almost exactly an acre. The layout of those exposure units is based on our understanding of the likelihood of contamination being there that would be of concern, based on our gamma walkover data and what we know about went on at this site. Ranging from the green exposure unit, where we really don't think that it's very likely that we have impacts that would be of concern, to the pale yellow or tan, where we know that there are impacts and they may be of concern, to the pink exposure unit, where we're pretty confident that we have impacts and there's a good chance that they're of concern. So we're grouping this site into exposure units based on contamination potential. You also see some dots on this map, and I'll talk more about those in subsequent slide, so don't worry about those right at the moment. So from a hotspot perspective, we're going to be concerned about their presence or absence in the two exposure units that have the greatest likelihood of contamination being present. We're not going to worry about them in the third exposure unit, which has a very low probability of contamination being there. So just to bear that in mind. Next slide, please. Slide 13. You've seen this slide before, or at least you've seen part of this slide before in a previous presentation. We know we have a heterogeneity issue at this site. This is showing you XRF results for a 1 square foot area from that footprint of that hotspot that we flagged. And you can see on the surface, that 5-point star, that our XRF results range from 30 ppm up to almost 500 ppm, or over an order of magnitude. On the right, you see a bar chart. And that bar chart actually shows you the XRF results for each of those five locations going down to depth in several inch intervals. And what this shows you is that, in fact, if one looks at this as a 1 square foot area down to a depth of a foot, so 1 cubic foot, our XRF concentrations actually vary from background to more than 1,000 ppm, so over 3 orders of magnitude. So depending on where you pull the sample from this particular 1 cubic foot block of soil, if you sent that sample off to the laboratory, you plausibly could come back with a result that was at background conditions for uranium versus a result that was over 1,000 ppm. And that is heterogeneity at play. Next slide, please. So we somehow have to accommodate the fact that we know we have a lot of heterogeneity going on at this site where there's contamination present, when we have contamination there. So what's our sampling strategy requirements? Well, we want to be able to show compliance with a wide area average criteria for uranium and PCBs for each of our exposure units, and we're going to use a 95% UCL comparison to do that. In other words, we're going to collect samples, we're going to analyze them, we're going to compute the average, we're going to develop a 95% UCL for that average, and then we're going to compare the 95% UCL with the standard that we have to attain. That's the first requirement. The second requirement is for those two exposure units that have a higher probability of contamination being present, we want to demonstrate that there are not any hotspot concerns. We already have evidence from our gamma walkover survey that, in fact, there is one. So we're going to verify exactly the fact that it exists with our sampling and also determine whether PCBs are involved or not. And then hopefully our data will be sufficient to support a surgical soil removal action if it's necessary, if it turns out that, in fact, we either fail to meet our hotspot criteria at one of our locations or one of our exposure units has an issue. We'd like to be able to deal with it on the fly. Next slide, please, slide 15. You've seen this slide before, too, but I'm just going to quickly, this one and one or two subsequent slides, but just to refresh your memory. One way of going after hotspots, again, is just to lay a dense grid down, one sampling point, say, for every 25 square meters in this case, since that's the definition of our hotspot, to sample them, to send the samples off to the laboratory and analyze them. Well, that would be expensive in this particular case, chasing PCBs that way. So instead, we're going to use composite search techniques to try to keep our costs to a minimum, our analytical costs, while still giving us the same level of confidence that if there's a hotspot there, we would have caught it. So the idea is we're going to be collecting samples, grouping them into increments, as is indicated here by the blue ovals, and then grouping them into composites, and then sending those composites off to the laboratory. Before we fund the composite, we'll be splitting each of those increments contributing to it, so we have one half of the splits that are archived that we can go back to and analyze if necessary. When we analyze those composites, we'll have a decision criteria that's set at something below our action level, and how far below depends on the number of increments contributing to our composite. And if one of our composites fails that decision criteria, we'll go back and analyze the archived increments that contributed to the composite and use those to locate where the hotspot is. And that's what this is showing you here. In this particular simple example, we cut our analytical costs by about 75% and still get the same level of performance in locating that hotspot. Next slide, please. Slide 16. We're actually going to take it a step further here, though. We're going to combine incremental averaging and composite searching together to both improve hotspot detections and to minimize our analytical costs. So we're going to use both strategies. And the result of that is we're going to have what's called bottom-tiered composite samples and top-tiered composite samples. And I'm going to show you an example of that here in just a moment. So if you could go on to slide 17. So here's our simple example expanded. And again, you've seen this before, so this should be a little bit of a review for you, but just to refresh your memory. What we're actually going to do is that each of our sampling locations, we're going to be collecting 5 increments and using those 5 increments to form lower tier composites. Those lower tier composites are going to be homogenized and split, and then half those splits are going to be used to form the upper tier composites. Those are the green and red triangles to the left of my square. And then those are going to be sent off to the laboratory for full analysis. If one of those comes back above our decision criteria, we're going to go back and analyze the offending lower tier composites to see which one was the problem. Now, why are we doing this? Because we know that if we are in a hotspot, just because we pull an increment from a hotspot doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to actually correctly identify that the hotspot is there. That's what heterogeneity does to us. By building an incremental sample, based on the area definition of our hotspot, we're going to be much more likely to correctly identify the presence of that hotspot. That's the reason for doing this. So it's to improve performance. Here, performance defined to be correctly identifying the presence of a hotspot when, in fact, it exists. Next slide, please. Slide 18. So, just as an overview of what we're attempting to do here, we've got high-density sampling coverage, both to control short-scale heterogeneity and the problems. It's going to help us find our hot spots, and it'll allow us then to go back and do finer delineation if necessary. It'll also provide us the information that we need to calculate our DU averages and support the development of a 95% UCL base for those averages. And hopefully we're going to get a much, much better decision-making confidence than what we would have otherwise at a significantly less cost. Slide 19. So, coming back to our site, we already know that there's likely a uranium hotspot present based on our gamma walkover data. We also have a sense that because that one exposure unit was in general impacted, that it might have average conditions that would be of concern as well. We're going to use our composite searching to cost-effectively address PCB hotspot concerns, because unfortunately we can't see PCBs with our gamma walkover survey, even though they may be there. And then we're going to use our incremental averaging concepts across our exposure units to show wide area average compliance. Again, calculating a 95% UCL based on those composite sample results. Next slide, please. Slide 20. So from each 25 square meter area within the two exposure units that had the highest likelihood of contamination being present, they're broken into 25 square meter areas, and for each of those, we collect one 5-increment composite. We'll call that a bottom tier or lower tier composite sample. It's homogenized and it's split. Each of those splits, you know, one of those is archived, the other is going to be used to form a top tier composite. The number of samples contributing to the top tier composites depends on the possibility of contamination. For that exposure unit where we are more concerned about contamination potentially being there at levels of concern, we're going to only aggregate 5 composite, lower tier composites into an upper tier composite. For the second exposure unit where we're a bit more confident that we don't have problems, we'll be a bit more brave and we'll composite 8. And remember that the decision criteria that we have to meet for the upper tier composite is based on the number of lower tier composites that are contributing to it. So in the case of where we have 8 lower tier being used to form one upper tier, there's a more stringent decision criteria that has to be met when that lab result comes back than for the case of 5. In this particular case, we have an XRF on site, we have PCB test kits on site, and we're doing this on the fly while we're there. So we're not necessarily waiting for results to come back from the laboratory, off-site laboratory, to make these decisions. Samples are being sent off to an off-site laboratory for QC, QA, QC purposes, but we're really driving this with our XRF and PCB test kits. Next slide, please. Slide 21. So here's a pictorial display of what this strategy looks like. In the upper left, well, first of all, each of the little green squares and triangles in the two exposure units with a greater likelihood of contamination being present, those represent 25 square meter areas. And so towards the upper left hand of this figure, you see one of those blown up, and you can see that there's a 5-point composite that's being formed from 5 increments. And that represents one of the bottom tier or lower tier composite samples. So there's going to be 5 increments collected from each of these 25 square meter areas forming a composite. Then in the lower part of this map, you can see for our pink exposure unit that we're here showing an example of 5 of these being grouped together into one 5 sample composite, while in the tan, adjacent tan, we're actually grouping 8 adjacent lower tier composites into one upper tier composite for analysis. And it's those upper tier composites that are being sent off site for analysis initially. So we have 68 of these 25 square meter areas for a total of around 1,700 square meters that we're trying to clear here of hotspot concerns. Next slide, please. Slide 22. So this was done, and the results came back. And no surprise, one of those upper tier composites was a problem. It failed for uranium, and it required the analysis of the 5 samples that contributed to the upper tier composite. As it turns out, that exposure unit also failed the 95% UCL check, and it was primarily because of the contamination in that hotspot that drove the overall average up to an unacceptable level. So when the lower tier composites were analyzed for that one upper tier that was the problem, one of those lower tier turned out to be that hotspot that we had seen with the gamma walkover survey. So yes, in fact, for this compositing strategy, we identified exactly the same hotspot that we saw with our gamma walkover survey. Based on that information, that particular hotspot was removed, the exposed soil was resampled, and reanalyzed. Those sample results were pooled back with the original data and the 95% the average result and the 95% UCL was then recalculated. And in fact, once the hotspot was removed, the exposure unit passed. The 95% UCL dropped down below its respective criteria that it had to meet. Slide 23. So in summary, for this particular example, there were 385 soil increments that were collected total. 190 from the first exposure unit, the one with the greatest possibility of contamination being present, 155 from the second, 40 from the third. So notice something here. We had different numbers of increments from each of our exposure units. And why? Well, it's because we had a much higher concern for the two exposure units that appeared to be potentially impacted than we did for the third. So we focused a lot more of our attention on those. Those increments were used to form 77 bottom-tiered increment average samples. There were 38 of those from the first exposure unit, 31 from the second, only 8 from the third. Those 77 bottom-tiered increment average samples were used to form 11 top-tier search composite samples that were then sent off for analysis. 7 from the first EU, 4 from the second. There were a total of 8 composite samples that came from the third EU. There were a total of 24 sample analyses done in all across these three exposure units. And you can do the math. There were the 11 top-tier search composites plus the 8 from the original third exposure unit, plus we had to go back and reanalyze one of the sets of lower-tier composites because of one of the upper-tier failed out decision criteria. It was 24 sample analyses in all. Those 24 sample analyses cleared 68 25 square meter areas of hotspot concerns. And they also demonstrated wide area average compliance for our three exposure units. So they did both things at the same time for us. Next slide, please. Slide 24. One of the questions people often ask is, why collect 5 increments per 25 square meter area when we're looking for hotspots? Now, you've already seen guidance that says, well, you're going to need potentially 30 increments to correctly calculate or to do a good job of calculating the average concentration that's present in a decision unit. So the point I'd like to make here is that for these hotspot areas, we're not concerned necessarily with getting the average exactly right. What we're concerned with is correctly identifying the fact that those things are hotspots, or verifying that they are not. If you do the math and assume, if you step back and assume that any individual sample has a 50-50 chance of identifying the presence of a hotspot if you were to sample within a hotspot, you can do the probability math, and it turns out that if you do a 5-sample composite, the probability that you're going to catch that hotspot goes up to around 97%. So a 5-sample composite gives us a pretty high confidence that if we collect a 5-sample composite from a hotspot, we're going to catch it and correctly identify that it is in fact there. So that's the rationale for 5-sample composites in this particular case. Slide 25. It's an interesting site because that particular hotspot was well characterized with an XRF because we really wanted to understand what was going on there. So we had a lot of XRF data from samples that were pulled from that hotspot before it was remediated. And one can do kind of a retrospective analysis on those XRF measurements. They were all discrete samples and say, well, okay, if one combined those into composites and then did the analysis, formed 2-sample composites, 3-sample composites, 4-sample composites, 5-sample composites, what would have been our detection performance from a hotspot perspective? And if one looks at it from a retrospective perspective for this hotspot, it turns out 5 increments would give us about an 85% detection rate. That would have been the actual performance. So not quite as good as theoretically we might have thought, but still much better than what a single increment would have done in terms of hotspot identification. Next slide, please. Slide 26. If you remember, again, a couple days ago, we talked about the fact that VSP actually has methods built in to allow you to calculate the number of samples you should lay down on a grid to identify hotspots, has a locating hotspot function associated with it. And one can do that. Go on to the next slide, please, slide 27. First of all, I have to apologize for slide 27. There's a mistake, and that is in the title, some of the information in the title text across the top is not consistent with the rest of the slide. It's the rest of the slide that's right, and not necessarily the text in the top that's right. But if you were to have used VSP in this particular case and assume that you had a 50% chance of correctly identifying a hotspot with a discrete sample, if in fact it was there and you sampled within its footprint, and then you said that you wanted to be 97% sure that you were going to identify the hotspot correctly, given a 50% false negative rate. And you can see the 50% false negative rates with the oval pink circled in one of those dialog boxes. If you get your glasses on and read the red text on that second panel on the right, with those assumptions, VSP comes back and says you would need exactly 363 samples to give you a 97% confidence level that in fact you would hit or you would find your hotspot. And that compares pretty closely to the 345 increments that we pulled from this particular area. The point here being, though, is the point in the box, and that is using this kind of dual composite averaging searching design with those 345 increments and only 16 analyses for our two exposure units where we had hotspot concerns would give us a hotspot identification performance at only 5% of the analytical cost as if we had gone ahead and analyzed every single one of those increments. So we're getting a tremendous amount of power from a hotspot identification perspective with a very relatively low analytical cost burden. Next slide, please. Slide 28. So, overall performance, our analytical burden for the first exposure unit was reduced by 68% using this approach. For the second exposure unit is reduced by 88%. And in fact, when you run the numbers up for the 1 acre as a whole, we get analytical costs that were only 12% of what they would have been if we had been treating this as a discrete sampling program and analyzing all the discrete samples to get the same performance. And that's the case study, slide 29. So, Gene, I guess if there are any questions from the audience, now would be the time to ask them.
Yep. We're going to start with the questions on the phone. If you're listening electronically, you can continue to type up questions through the question mark form. I've got a bunch of them in the queue. But before we turn to those, let's start with those of you on the phone. If you're on the phone and you'd like to ask a question, you can take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and then we'd ask you to identify yourself or organization.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, this is Bruce Castle at Erler and Kalinowski in Burlingame. And my question is, in terms of the actual PCB analyses done in the laboratory, did the laboratory, in fact, follow an incremental subsampling protocol involving, you know, a minimum of 30 or however many increments to actually form up the sample that was analyzed?
No. The short answer to that is no, they didn't. And in retrospect, in this particular case, we wish they had. You raised an interesting question. And of course, we've hammered on it throughout the presentations here, the importance of proper composite sample handling in the laboratory and subsampling techniques that are used. In this particular case, we had laboratory results with paired on-site results for both uranium and for PCBs. In general, the results coincided. indicating that the protocol that the laboratory was using for homogenizing, there were protocols for homogenizing the samples, but they weren't multiply subsampled. That it wasn't too bad, but I think we could have done better if we had used a multiple subsampling approach for the composite samples in the laboratory. And actually, the other interesting about it is the uranium numbers agreed much better than what the PCB numbers did. And it attributed that primarily to the fact there's a lot more noise in the total PCB analyses than what there is in the uranium analyses. So partly what we were seeing was still that residual heterogeneity in the composite sample at the laboratory that was being subsampled. Part of it is noise coming off the analytical technique.
Right. So on the uranium side, XRF, correct me if I'm wrong, but doesn't it provide sort of a very narrow beam? And in essence, it's almost the equivalent of the 1 gram sample that's traditionally digested in the lab for metals. It's a very small, in essence, a very small subsample that is underneath the XRF result.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the way to get around that, and the way we got around that in this particular case, is the on-site samples that were analyzed were homogenized, but then were shot through a bag. And those actually were multiple shots through the bag. So it was the equivalent of doing kind of multiple subsampling that we're suggesting ought to be done in the laboratory. To account for the fact that, in fact, each of those individual XRF measurements has a very, very small sample support associated with it. And unless your sample was completely thoroughly homogenized, you'd be concerned that you're getting stung by within-sample heterogeneity. Taking multiple shots around the bag and then averaging those addresses that. So that's what was actually done in this particular case. And what, the other curious thing about that is those samples were fairly thoroughly homogenized with field protocols prior to XRF analysis. For those samples, though, that sample masses that had a fair amount of uranium in them, there was still we observed a significant amount of heterogeneity still present in those samples, visible in the multiple shots done to the bag walls that hadn't been completely stamped out by the field homogenization process.
Sure, it speaks to the particulate nature of the uranium.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Very good. Thank you.
Okay, great. Bob, I'm going to start taking a couple of questions that have come in online. And the first question is asking from Honolulu, Hawaii. They ask, which test kit was used at the uranium site?
You know, just before I gave this presentation, I was thinking, somebody's going to ask me that question. And this is a couple of years old. I believe it was Abraxas. And Dina, maybe your memory's better than mine, but I believe that was the test kit that was used in this particular case.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Yeah, I off the top of my head, I think it was kits by Abraxas, but I'd have to go back and check.
Along the same lines, they want to know if you can recommend a test kit for PCBs in a humid climate and choline soil.
You know, I am going to punt that question to Dina because she has more experience with this than I do. Dina, would you have any recommendations?
Off the top of my head, no. You'd have to research the various PCB kits, and there are quite a few of them out there, and call the manufacturer and discuss it with them.
Okay. The next question is in reference to slide 12, and they ask, how do you know that the green area was, quote, low concentration prior to sampling, or why were there less samples taken?
Yeah, that's a good question. There's really two pieces of information that feed into this breaking out, the way we broke this area out into exposure units. The first was just our knowledge of the way contamination should have taken place at the site. And that is, we would expect to see contamination along the borders of the ditches and the streams, because that's where spoils from the dredging would have been dumped. And as you get away from the stream banks, we would expect the likelihood of contamination to drop the further away you get. The second thing we have, though, in this particular case, is we also have before we did the physical sampling, we had the gamma walkover survey results. And again, those gave us a pretty clear indication of where there was surface uranium contamination and where there wasn't. And that turned out to be consistent with our expectations in terms of where we thought we would find contamination based on the way dredging would have taken place at the site. So it's those two things that drove the way the site was carved up into exposure units.
Okay. Our next question is coming in from Boulder, Colorado, and they ask in reference to slide 14, Would you keep each depth interval separate or averaging by depth interval?
In this particular case, the hotspot criteria, both the surface soil average criteria and the hotspot criteria applied to soils down to a depth of 6 inches. So we were basically pulling our samples down to that depth and homogenizing them over that depth profile. Now, when we were doing the probing with the XRF, we had the ability to be much more discriminatory in terms of the vertical layers we were looking at, because XRF is just such a great field instrument for doing that kind of thing. So we had more detailed information than that in terms of the vertical location of uranium. But for decision-making purposes, the way the criteria had been defined, it was really the top 6 inches that was of interest.
Okay. Our next question is coming in also from Honolulu, and they state, so it's acceptable to clear a 25-square-meter hotspot with only a 5-point composite sample versus a 30-point incremental sample. How can you clear a hotspot if you don't know the uranium average?
I think, that, again, it gets back to the point that in this particular case, I mean, when we're trying to demonstrate compliance with an area-wide average goal, and we want to be really confident that it's below that. And to that end, we use a 95% UCL and compare the 95% UCL against the criteria rather than the actual average that was computed. There, we're trying to be very accurately quantitative in that value. When we're looking for a hotspot here, really what we're looking for is a yes-no kind of thing. Are we likely above that hotspot criteria, or are we likely below? And we're not as concerned with getting the average exactly right. And so, again, go through the math, but in this particular case, a 5-point increment does a pretty good job of giving us, of answering that yes-no question. Now, does it accurately estimate the average concentration the way a 30 increment would? No. But do we need all 30 increments to get to the decision that we need to make? And again, the answer to that is, in this particular case, no, not really. In this particular case, again, the proof is kind of in the pudding. We knew from the Galileo survey that there was a hotspot, and it turned out that the 5-point increments were effective in identifying its presence. When we just looked at the 5-point increment results, it picked it out as well.
Okay. Our next question is coming in from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and they state, this seems to be a fine way to go for chemicals with long hold times. What about analyzing for VOAs or other short hold times? Resampling again may not find the hotspot, and remobilization would drive your costs higher.
Yeah, and we already talked about limitations of using composite samples for certain types of contaminants of concern. Hold times could be an issue, but also contaminant loss could be an issue from sample handling. That's a concern. One of the things that is going on here is that we are, in this particular case, we are actually doing our analyses in the field. So our hold times on these samples for the field analyses were very, very short. Could you do that for every analyte of concern or contaminant of concern? No, not necessarily, but that was true in this particular case.
Okay, we'll take one more question, and then we'll carry on. And this last question is coming in from North Point, Washington. And they ask, what about PCB? Was it distributed the same as uranium? What was the corresponding PCB data?
Yeah, that's a great question. As it turns out, in this particular case, the PCB contamination was more spotty than what the uranium was, but there was never what we discovered was that there was, and I guess we kind of suspected this, there was never PCB contamination without the presence of elevated uranium. There were elevated uranium spots without measurable PCB contamination, but the reverse was not true. And in this particular case, it turned out we didn't see any PCBs, although we measured PCBs, we had measurable levels, we didn't see any that would have caused us to fail either our hotspot criteria or our exposure units, our wide criteria. In this particular case, it all turned out to be driven by the uranium that was there, not the PCBs.
Okay, great. Thanks so much, Bob.
Okay,
we're gonna resume our presentation with slide number 30, and this is just a quick time check. It is 2:50 Eastern, and we're on slide number 30.
So this is a case study reporting the results of an experimental field study looking at incremental sampling and sample processing. On the slide 31, four questions can be addressed by this field study. The first question is, does grinding a sample increase the leaching of metals during analytical sample digestion? If yes, this could bias the results in that metal would be measured that would not normally be measured by traditional analysis. And risk assessors don't want to know about that extra metal in the measurement because it would probably not be bioavailable in situ. Second question that the study could answer is there a benefit to grinding? In other words, does grinding reduce the variability from particle effects? A third question is, how comparable is the data between incremental sampling and an equivalent discrete sampling design? And what about cost? On to slide 32. First, some particulars about the study. It was performed by EPA Region 3. The contamination was lead, arsenic, antimony, and PAHs because this area was a former skeet and trap range. I'm only going to talk about the metals data here. The DUs were based on different ecozones, and we'll see more about that in a minute. As we know, lead is the major component of shot bullets. It's usually 85% or more, and antimony and arsenic are both added to these bullets to increase the hardness. On to slide 33. This is a picture of the layout for the skeet and the trap range. One of the things I had to look up when I first heard about this study is what's the difference between a trap and a skeet range. And it turns out that a skeet range, the clay pigeon is shot from across, from right to left across your viewing line of sight. As regard to a trap range, the clay pigeon comes from over the back of your head and then travels directly in front of you. Slide 34. So these are the DUs, and you can see they're quite irregular in shape. DU1 was a forested tidal wetland. VU2 was also wetland with tidal influence, but it was associated with a creek. VU3 was a brackish tidal marsh. VU4 was upland forest. VU5 was the actual stream bed of the creek, and DU6 was also brackish tidal marsh associated with the creek. Go on to slide 35. This shows that for sampling the marsh, they had to use some adaptive tools. So to keep from sinking into the marsh, they used these pieces of plywood. Going on to the next slide. And you can see that they would put the plywood down, walk on it, and then put the other piece down and walk on that and then bring the back one forward. Next slide. This is a picture of the sampling tool that was used to do the incremental sampling for the upland forest. This is a picture of DU4, the upland forest. One, two, you can see that it's a core. Go on to the next slide. Slide 38 shows how this was used. There's a little platform there that can be used to use your weight to push the core down into the soil. Go on to the next slide, 39. Waiting for the slides to load because the pictures, they load kind of slow even for us. This is a picture of them ejecting the core from the core barrel and placing it in the plastic bag to collect that particular incremental sample. There's a lever up there where the guy's hand is pushing on to push the core out. Next slide, slide 40. So let's talk about the fate of lead shot in the environment. Next slide, 41. So some background information. First of all, shot is not stable in the soil, but it corrodes. These constituents transform into minerals from the corrosion, and some of these minerals dissolve in water. The more organic carbon you have, the more water you have, and the more oxygen you have, the faster the shot corrodes. So in a wetland environment, the shot, especially in the upper surfaces of the wetland stratigraphy, the shot can corrode pretty quickly. Slide 42. The little picture there shows corrosion coming off the surface of the bullet. This happens to be lead carbonate crust. You can also get lead oxide crust. These crusts tend to be fairly soluble. They can also flake off and integrate into the soil matrix as particles. And then they would be particles of concentrated lead. But if they dissolve and the lead atoms are then released into the soil, then they're free to absorb onto soil minerals and organic carbon particles. But eventually, this lead may form insoluble lead minerals. On slide 43. This is a picture of looking at an example of an insoluble lead mineral. It's insoluble to water. It would be soluble to acid digestion. By analytical techniques, and I'm not sure about the bioavailability. But panel A is just a light image of this grain, and you want to look at the one, it sort of looks like a dog there in the center. Panel B is an elemental analysis for calcium, and you can see that there's no calcium really in that mineral particle. Panel C is looking at phosphorus, and this is in fact a phosphate-based mineral, so you do see the outline of the particle there looking at the element phosphorus. And in D, this is looking at the element lead, and certainly we can see a concentrated lead particle there on the slide 44. This photomicrograph is not from the same project, it's from another project, but in this case, you've seen this one before, you might remember that it represents arsenic that's been absorbed to iron oxide minerals, and that the iron in a cubic yard of soil, which is anywhere from 1 to 1.5 tons, is capable of absorbing one half to five pounds of soluble metals or organics. So there is a lot of absorptive capacity in most soils, either from organic carbon or from clays or from iron oxides. And when these contaminants glom on to these particulate materials, they behave as particulates themselves. On to slide 45. So there's also nuggets generated from actual metal dust, so pure elemental lead or lead arsenic antimony nuggets. One of the ways lead dust is generated is from lead primers in firing bullets. And then there's also scraping of bullets against the barrel rifling, and that'll generate pure little pellets, tiny, tiny dust pellets of lead, arsenic, antimony. Of course, these tiny dust particles will degrade faster than the bullet itself, which will have less surface area. There's also a release of lead, antimony, and arsenic through the abrasion of the bullet as it travels through soil. There's experiments done by the authors of the article that's referenced there. They showed that if you shot a bullet through sand, an average of 41 milligrams of mass was lost. On to slide 46. We'll talk about the study design. As I mentioned, there's the ecozones for DU1 through DU6. It also gives the number of increments per incremental sample that were collected, and it gives the area. For DU4, there was 100 increments and 1.6 acres for this forested upland, and we'll see that this DU4 was also the DU that had a high density of discrete sampling to develop information about the comparability between discrete sampling and incremental sampling. We can go on to the next slide, 48. So, the way the samples were processed was that these field increments were added to that large plastic bag that you saw in the picture. It was sent to the lab. In this experiment, the lab did all of the sample processing. So in the lab, the soil was air dried and crushed to break up clods of soil. It was then sieved, and everything that passed through a 10-mesh sieve was retained. And a 10-mesh sieve screens out things that are over about 2 millimeters in diameter. Some of these sieve samples were subsampled before grinding, and then the same sample was sampled after grinding so that we could see the difference between pre-ground and post-ground concentrations for the samples. The grinding was pretty thorough. They estimate that the grinding took it down to about 74 micrometers, which is about 200 mesh. On slide 49, this picture is not from this particular project, but it would have been about the same. You can see how bag samples are labeled and stored in the laboratory. On to slide 50. Then they're laid out on cookie trays to a fairly shallow depth so that they'll dry quickly. Here they're being air dried. On to slide 51. Here it shows being sieved through a 10-mesh sieve. Slide 52. Grinding, this is the same type of grinder that was used in the Fort Eustis project. It's called a puck mill grinder. And as you can see in the photograph on the right, there's this large hunk of metal in there called a puck. And the soil is put in there, and then the puck is added, and then the lid's put on, and it's put inside that piece of equipment on the left and shaken for depending on how it's done, sometimes the shaking is only done in 30-second spurts to allow cool down so that the sample does not get hot and drive off more volatile constituents such as the low molecular weight PAHs. One of the drawbacks of this particular design was that the container is made out of stainless steel, and we'll see see later that chromium leaches or bleeds from the stainless steel in the presence of this kind of grinding. So you would not want to use a stainless steel grinder if chromium is one of your analytes of concern. Qantas 553. And this shows subsampling using a two-dimensional slab cake and doing incremental subsampling so that you get a good representation from across the subsample into the analytical sample. Slide 54. This is a tabular form of the study design layout. All of the DUs had field replicates, so they all got three incremental samples, three replicate incremental samples. Three of the replicates, 2, 4, and 6, had that pre and post grind replication that I mentioned before. After sieving, 5 subsamples were taken before grinding, and then 5 samples were taken from the same sample after it was ground. For the other 3 DUs, they did only laboratory post-grind replicates to look at the variability obtained when you ground the samples. And then DU4 had the discrete samples, and there were 49 of those. Slide 55. This attempts to lay out in picture form what I've basically just said, but it might be a little easier to grasp quickly. This illustrates for DU1, 3, and 5 the process of the bag sample coming to the lab, it being sieved, and it being ground, and then 3 replicate subsamples being taken. On the slide 56. And this is similar to the QC replication procedure that I covered on day 2, I believe, where you have replication at the level of the field, where you have the incremental sample is replicated 3 times, independent replicates. And then after the sample was processed, you have replicate subsampling from the, from 3 individual slab cakes. Go on to slide 57. For DUs 2, 4, and 6, these are the ones that have the ground versus unground replication. So again, it shows it in picture form where you've got the lab receiving the sample, it being sieved, and then 5 replicate subsamples taken from it while it's unground, and then grinding it, and then taking 5 replicate ground subsamples. And that was done for DUs 2, 4, and 6. And then for DU4, as I mentioned, they had 49 discrete samples. I say, why 49? Well, it was originally supposed to be 50, but something happened to one of them and it disappeared. So they ended up with 49. Showing one batch of the discrete samples had replicate unground subsamples taken to see the difference between the variability with the unground subsamples, and then the sample was ground, and then a single ground subsample was taken. And for the rest of the batch of discrete samples, you simply had it straight, sieving, grinding, and subsampled once. Slide 59, the findings of the study. Slide 60. So the question, Does grinding increase metal solubilization during digestion? Well, the short answer was, at least not consistently in this study. The long answer is that for two of the DUs, DU 4 and 6, there was no difference between unground and ground concentrations. But for DU 2, which was a forest and wetland, did show statistical elevation of antimony, arsenic, and lead in the ground versus the unground samples. So the ground samples were higher than the unground samples. From how the study was done, there's no way to rule out that there might be something special about this DU2 matrix that caused greater solubilization from the ground samples. Some studies suggest that matrices with larger pre-grind particle sizes, such as sands and larger, are more likely to show higher ground concentrations than matrices from small pre-grind particles such as clays and silts. So this kind of makes sense. There's been another number of studies by some laboratories trying to nail down this question about whether grinding increases the leaching during sample preparation. And some studies show it and some studies don't. So they're suggesting that one of the reasons might be the particle size of the original matrix. And that kind of makes sense because if you have larger original particle sizes, they're going to ground up more to increase the surface area than with smaller particle sizes, which are already pretty small and have a large surface area. But this explanation doesn't fully explain the findings of this study because other metals in DU's data set did not show this pattern with the exception of aluminum. For aluminum, it was a little higher after grinding, but all the other mineral elements such as iron, manganese, nickel, vanadium, and zinc did not change their concentrations. And we'll see that there's another explanation for why higher levels are sometimes observed in ground samples, and that's due to particle effects. Slide 61. So particle effects can make it appear that ground concentrations are higher than unground. I want to remind you of what happens when you have particle effects. And this is a slide that combines some slides that you saw earlier in the webinar. If you have fairly large particle sizes and concurrently have particles that have a high burden of contamination, you're likely to get some subsamples, such as subsample A, which tends to have fewer contaminated particles collected within it, and then you end up with a low concentration after it's digested and run through the instrument. On the other hand, it's possible that you'll get an abnormally high concentration of particles in a subsample as represented by subsample B, and then you get a high concentration, so you get a high result. On the other hand, with grinding, the goal is to create a more uniform matrix. Now, particle effects will not completely disappear, and we'll see that, but it certainly generally improves things. So subsample C, we sort of expect that the highs and the lows would be averaged out. So we don't expect to see concentrations as low as we would with subsample A, or concentrations as high as we would with subsample B. On to slide 62. This is an example of this phenomenon. There were five replicate lab subsamples from the same sample, and this is the unground stage of the sample. Plotted here is the antimony, arsenic, and lead. Note that lead has its own axis because of the concentration differences
So the lead axis is on the right side of the graph. But you see a very strong correlation between lead, arsenic, and antimony, that when one was high, the other ones were high, and when they were low, they were all low. But what's kind of shocking is the degree of variability. And I put the range of values there on the, near the top of the slide, where antimony averaged from, not average, but the range of antimony was from 8 to 530. Arsenic was from 11 to 234. And lead ranged from 4,000 to 29,000. On the slide 63. Now, after this same sample was ground, there was a lot less variability in the concentrations. But you can still see from the graph that there's quite a lot of correlation still present. The elements go up and down at in the same pattern. But the post-grind ranges, you notice, the antimony was from 18 to 26, certainly a lot tighter. The arsenic, 18 to 25, again, much tighter. And the lead from right around 5,000 plus or minus 400. Now, if you notice, the low end of the pre-grind ranges is lower than the low end of the post-grind ranges that applied across the board. And, of course, those very high concentrations are much lower. Slide 64. I thought it would be interesting to look at the ratio between the elements and comparing a bullet composition to the soil ratios that we were seeing. And lo and behold, the ratios were very, very similar when you looked at soil concentrations that were showing particle effects. Possibly this is due to the dust coming off the bullets as they're hitting the ground, they're hitting rocks. Go on to slide 65. This is a summary of across the entire experimental project. There turned out to be basically four trials that tested whether the analyte concentrations increased after grinding. And so across those four trials, you can see like aluminum. In three of the trials, the concentration was statistically higher, and one of the trials, it was the same. For antimony, three of the trials were higher, and one of the trials was lower. For going down to, like, barium, in all four of the trials, the concentration of barium did not change from pre-grind to post-grind. If you go down to the bottom at the totals, you can see that certainly the number of trials where the concentrations stayed the same and got lower is a lot greater than the trials where the concentration got higher. But on the other hand, if it was completely due to chance as to whether it got higher or lower, you wouldn't expect to see 21 higher and 6 lower. That's quite a bit of difference to attribute to chance, so there must be something else going on. Move to slide 66. So why do we sometimes see higher metal concentrations in ground samples? Well, part of the explanation is chance. Let's go on to slide 67. But on the other hand, it could be particle effects. This is showing just for lead, the unground concentrations compared to the ground concentrations, and they're laid on the same graph. So you can see the variability is way, way, way lower with the ground samples. Now remember, these unground samples were sieved, but they weren't ground, whereas ground concentration is obviously sieved, and then ground later after the unground subsamples were taken. In both cases, the concentration of that big incremental sample was 5,000, around 5,000, which is about the middle range for the post-grind range. So the concentration in the pre-ground sample has to be the same. It's the same sample. But you don't get 5,000 if you average the 5 unground replicates. You get something around 17,000 because the results are biased by those very high concentrations due to particle effects. Slide 68. So why does this tend to increase, make an apparent increase in ground concentrations? Well, hearkening back to our figure there, subsample A is in the lower concentrations, and we know from experience and from discussions that Bob had earlier in the seminar that the low concentrations tend to predominate, so we get this log normal looking curve. We get a lot of low concentrations, meaning that fewer hot particles were picked up, but we also get these very high concentrations which cause the tail to pull out to the right. The true mean is somewhere between the high and the low concentrations. If we grind the sample and we get a subsample that has a result that's close to the true mean for that large sample bag, but most of the time just probability means that we're going to get subsample A, which is lower concentrations. So just by probability, especially if you're only comparing, you know, doing one-to-one unground versus ground samples, the chance is that just due to particle effects that you will get lower unground concentrations and the concentration will be higher after it's ground. But this has nothing to do with the leaching or increased sample, increased surface area. It's just due to the probability and the log normal distributions that we see in traditional environmental data. On to slide 69. So did grinding provide a benefit in this project? Slide 70. Well, across the whole study, there were 3 variability trials that could be used to derive data that addresses this question. Counting up across all analytes and all DUs, variability decreased statistically after grinding 15 out of 51 times, so 29% of the time the variability decreased. 8% of the time the variability actually increased, which is probably just due to chance, and it remained unchanged 63% of the time. For the 3 primary analytes of interest, the variability decreased 45% of the time, increased 3 out of 9 times, and remained unchanged for 2 out of 9 times. You can go on to slide 71. So did grinding reduce variability? Well, sometimes it did, especially for mercury and nickel. These consistently saw decreased variability across all 3 trials. But other metals were variable, and it was variable depending on the DUs.
DUs 2 and 6 showed no statistically significant reduction in variability, but DU 4 did. Now, if you remember, DUs 2 and 4 were wetland filarias, which probably had fine grain materials and organic carbon present that was already small, fine grained. DU 4, on the other hand, did show a significant reduction in variability after grinding. And DU4 was the upland forest, which probably had a coarser particle distribution than the wetlands. And remember that all the samples had been sieved, including the on-ground samples. So for most of these matrices, possibly sieving was just as effective as grinding because these matrices were mostly fine-grained soils or sediments. Slide 72. So the conclusions from the variability experiments, overall beta variability was unchanged or reduced by grinding, and sometimes the reduction was quite extreme, as we saw from the example. Occasionally the analyte variability increased after grinding, but it was such a low rate that it's probably just due to chance. Sieving, particle size, and organic carbon levels are probably factors in addition to grinding that could influence microscale heterogeneity and thus influence data variability. The incremental sampling procedures gave relative standard deviations, which is a measure of variability. For the three replicate field incremental samples that were less than 20% for metal and analytes, except for antimony, arsenic, and lead. For those target analytes, the variability ranged up to 82%. And this is partly due to the pretty high concentrations and the fact that even grinding can't totally eliminate particle effects when you have pure elemental dust and such in your soil. One of the things that this points out is you need to consider how any of your samples are processed or subsampled by the laboratory, regardless of whether they're incremental samples or discrete samples. You know, discrete samples obviously are very prone to being affected by microheterogeneity. And if you do not process your incremental samples correctly, all of the effort that you took to put into collecting increments in the field will be lost because you will get the variability coming out of the subsampling side, and it will ruin your ability to interpret the field incremental sample replicates. Slide 73, comparability between discrete and incremental data sets, 74. So there was only one DU that addressed this question. That was DU4. Had 49 discrete samples. ProUCL was used to determine the statistical distribution for each analyte's data set, its mean, and its 95% UCL. For the incremental sample results, these were independent triplicates from the field, and we calculated a DU mean and a 95% TUCL for each analyte. On to slide 75. This shows the results for the three target analytes. The darker pink at the top, where we have the mean for the 49 discrete samples, and the line underneath it, which is the mean for the triplicate incremental samples. And again, these were comparing apples and apples, so we're comparing ground samples to ground samples. This was actually kind of amazing. For antimony, arsenic, and lead, the closeness of the means was just amazing. The RPD between the means was 2% and less. You can see, though, that the standard deviation
for the 49 discrete samples was higher than the standard deviation, which is the line below it. From the incremental samples, for example, with antimony, the standard deviation, a measure of variability for the 49 discrete samples was 51 versus 33 for the incremental sample replicates.
The discrete data distribution
was non-normal for these analytes. Pro-UCL gave the distribution as gamma or non-parametric for nearly all of the analytes, including these three targets. If you look at the UCLs that you got from discrete sampling versus the incremental sampling, despite the fact that the standard deviation for the 49 discretes is higher than the standard deviation for the incremental samples, the UCLs still come out lower for the discrete samples than for the incremental samples. So therefore, antimony, pro-UCL recommended a 95% UCL for antimony of 53 versus a calculated TUCL for the triplicate incremental samples of 94. And that's the penalty you pay for having only three replicates of incremental samples versus having 49 discrete samples. But if you look at whether the two results are statistically equivalent, yes, they are across the board. Slide 76. This is just a summary of the comparability for all of the elements. The RPD between the mean of the 49 discrete samples and the mean of the triplicate incremental samples was less than 10% for a majority of the elements. The RPD between the means was between 10 and 35% for three more of the elements, barium, copper, and manganese. It was greater than 50% and less than 100% for calcium, cadmium, and chromium. Chromium we disregard because it was affected by bleed from the grinder itself. Cadmium, the mean of the discrete sample is 0.3 versus the mean of the incremental sample is 0.1. So in absolute terms, they're very close. But the cadmium values were very precise, which led to seeing a large difference between the RPDs, between the means, as well as statistically different data sets. None of the difference between the means was greater than 100%. On slide 77, so the summary for grinding is that from this study alone, we can't say whether grinding would produce non-representative high metals results. So until more experience is accumulated, more studies have done, you should probably consider checking your matrix and consider your CSM if the risk assessment is contingent upon knowing the bioavailability of your analytes. You should probably consider doing a small study to see whether there is an increase with grinding. So if you can't grind, what can you do? Well, you can increase your sample mass some more. The sample mass that was used for this study for metals was 2.5 grams, going up to 8 to 10 grams would probably counteract the fact that you can't grind, but
a lot of laboratories aren't set up to extract such a large volume of soil.
But there may be laboratories now that are set up to do that. If the native particle size is already small, grinding might provide little additional benefit, especially if larger analytical masses are used. And for data comparability, incremental sampling produces data that is comparable to a discrete sampling design when there is enough discrete samples so that the population is accurately reflected. If there are not enough discrete samples to accurately reflect the population and capture the variability across the population, then you can't expect the discrete samples and the incremental samples to be comparable. 78. As far as costs, this is a summary of cost information. There was a greater breakdown of the costs in the study. I didn't put all of that in on account of time that would take to go through it, but if anybody is really interested in the breakdown, then contact me and I can send them those slides. But basically, the discrete sampling for DU4 costs quite a bit more than the incremental sampling for the replicates of 100 increments each. Some of that cost was the field labor involved in collecting 49 discrete samples, and then it includes the paperwork, which is labeling 49 discrete samples and doing chain of custody for 49 discrete samples versus only three for the MIS samples. For the analytical, obviously the cost of analyzing three was a lot more than analyzing 49. These costs did include the cost of sample preparation, which was done for discrete as well as the incremental samples. And I believe that's the last slide. So we can go to questions.
Okay. Well, again, we're on slide number 79. Those of you on the phone, I'll invite you to ask your questions first. Anyone streaming audio, you can continue to type up your comments or questions electronically, and we'll switch to those in just a few minutes. So if you're on the telephone line and you have a comment or question, take yourself off of mute by hitting #6, and then we'd ask you to identify yourself and organization.
Hey, hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, this is Bruce Castle in with Erler and Kalowski in Burlingame again. And there's a very good analogy between the experience of grinding samples that contain native gold to samples containing, in essence, native lead, which is what was happening here. And that is, you can never really, in a ring and puck pulverizer, you can never really reduce those down to the minus 200 mesh, completely to the minus 200 mesh size, because they basically get flattened and fragmented a little bit, but you will end up with particles that, because they're heavy and because they're metallic and malleable, those characteristics will prevent them from being completely, evenly, ground, and therefore finding what you found in this study where the particle effect seemed to persist, or a reduced version of the particle effect persisted even in the after the grinding, is quite lawful. Again, from mining, I've seen that many times.
Thank you for that comment. That's educational.
Great, thank you. Anybody else on the phone? Again, a question or comment. It's #6 to unmute. Okay, then I'll move on to the ones that have been submitted electronically. And the first one is coming in from Nashville, Tennessee. And they ask, in reference to slide number 39, did you have to be concerned at all with decontamination between the incremental sampling locations? If not, why?
When you're collecting increments for a single incremental sample, you don't have to decontaminate between incremental locations, because you're looking for a mean of, you know, across the whole DU, so you do not have to decontaminate between the increments. You may want to decontaminate, though, between replicates.
probably, again, depends on the soil and how much soil is sticking to your core as to whether you need to decontaminate between replicates. But it's probably a good idea because those should be independent replicates.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Washington State, and they ask, why did you sieve out the actual lead shot by using a 10-mesh screen? Skeet and trap shot is greater than 2 millimeters?
I wasn't part of the study design. I sort of got it afterwards. I assume that they actually had lead shot that got screened out, but they were looking at the concentration of lead in soil for this study. Remember, this was an experimental study. The data was not used to make any kind of decisions. It was only to look at variability within the soil and whether grinding could resolve that variability and those particle effects, and to establish whether there was a comparability between a discrete data set and an incremental data set, and certainly the presence of pellets would have really ruined that. And as it was mentioned before, those pellets can be malleable and possibly smear on the grinder surface, and you wouldn't want to do that.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Sacramento, California, and they ask, what other effective grinding options are available that involve non-metallic vessels, pucks, et cetera, that provide the same sorting while avoiding introducing the problematic constituents you mentioned, such as chromium?
There are porcelain, I believe, options and agate options for grinding, for grinders. I think the agate is extremely hard but also pretty expensive. The porcelain options, I don't know the details about it, but it could be an option for at least certain metallic elements because it shouldn't be donating metal to it. But again, remember, if possible, if your native particle size is already small, you may be able to get away without grinding under certain circumstances.
Okay. Related to that, we have a question that came in from Boulder, Colorado, and they mentioned that they recently used chromium-free puck mill bowls to grind their samples. And they wanted to know if you were aware of that type of bowl and is it adequate for a grinding program?
I do not know anything about the chromium-free puck mill bowls other than their existence, but that's the end of my knowing.
Okay. Our next question comes in from Chatsworth, California, and they're talking about slide number 63. There's a correlation between arsenic, lead, and I'm so sorry for the third element that you guys, antimony?
Lead,
arsenic, lead, and antimony?
Yeah.
Okay, sorry. Typical battery plates are made of lead, which is seeded with antimony and arsenic to derive different battery properties. Are these matrix, arsenic, lead, and antimony ratios natural, derived, to be man-made? We sometimes use these ratios to fingerprint their sources, for example, lead smelters, lead paint, tetraethyl lead.
I'm not sure if there's a question there or just a good comment.
In this case, probably the ratios could be used as a signature because the ratios in the soil match the ratio in the original shot composition really, really well. And I would suspect that you would have different ratios for those other sources of lead and arsenic.
Okay. We have a few questions that came in online that I think refer to different portions of the presentation. So I'm not sure if you guys would like to continue on or if you want to go through the questions that were in the queue from earlier parts.
We're going to have more questions until the end of our time.
So let's go through the resources.
Okay.
Make sure we get to those, and then we can go back to more questions if we have them.
Okay. So, again, we're going to resume the presentation at slide number 80, but we will continue to take questions. So if you have more, you can type them into that electronic question queue or just hang tight on the phones. We'll get back to you for additional questions.
Yeah, this will go quick. We just wanted to make you aware of the range of Internet resources that are available. You go on to slide 81. Certainly the Cluin website you're all familiar with, but there's also a Brownfields Technology Support Center, which is to support Brownfields.
It has technical information on it as well
as grant information and such. The Triad Resource Center has information about particle effects and heterogeneity and the need to manage that. And I won't go through all these websites, but just to make you aware that they're there. And 82. These are links to free software.
SADA is a geostatistical-based
decision assistance software
that's free because it was developed with public money.
VSP is free from the website that you see there. What's also really useful is the Corps of Engineers engineering manuals. They are a great source of information, and there's a internet link there that shows where those engineering manuals can be found. Sampling design assistance, these documents are actually on your list on the resources section, but there are other websites that could be useful. And 84, just continuing on for more sampling assistance. And 85, just more references to sample collection information from the Corps of Engineer reports. Places to get more information, like the SWA 46 method that provides the incremental soil sampling design and sample processing guidance for SWA 46. 86. It's just a screenshot of the Triad Resource Center. Next slide. Selected articles describing the Triad approach. As you could see, the way Bob handled his case study and Michael Stroh's case study with XRF, you can combine these very efficient sampling designs with field methods to help speed things along and end up with very, very efficient designs that are much less costly, but usually their performance is quite a bit better than traditional discrete sampling design. 88. That's more articles. 89.
And
more articles. 90.
There we go. So we can
address the rest of the questions.
Okay, great. So we're going to go back to the phone line. If you're on the phone and you have any other questions or comments, and again, this will refer to any one of the modules, so 1, 2, 3, or 4, if you have a comment or question, please feel free to take yourself off of mute by hitting #6 and then identify yourself or your organization.
Hello?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hello?
Yep, you're here.
Okay, yes, this is Bruce Castle at in Burlingame again. I sort of two comments on questions that came in. The I've used different kinds of bowls for ring and puck pulverizing. The what's called the chromium free tends to be a high manganese steel, so manganese and iron are really the only real contaminants that show up in it. Very good bowl for larger samples. The agate bowl that Deanna mentioned is a good one. There's a tungsten carbide bowl. There's a zirconia bowl. And those generally have very low concentrations of anything you'd be concerned about. I've used them quite successfully. They perform very well. They tend to be difficult to find. You have to go to the specialty mining geochemical labs to find them, but they are out and around. And sort of the second comment is on the skeet shot. All the skeet range data that I've looked at, an actual skeet range material, would pass through a 10 mesh sieve. It'll get caught up on a 20 because of the size of the BBs, but generally would pass through a 10 mesh sieve.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you so much for that information about the grinders. It's very, very useful.
Okay, thank you.
Great. Anybody else on the phone? Again, it's #6. Okay. I will then continue to go through the electronic questions that have been submitted. And this first question actually came in before we started the seminar, so I think it probably had to do with a previous session, but I'm not sure. So I'm just going to read this question as it's been written, again, coming in from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. They ask, what is the relationship between size of the DU and the number of increments needed?
Oh, that's a really, really good question. There is no rule of thumb that's been developed at this point, with the exception of using 30 increments for DU sizes that generally reflect residential lot sizes, which is around a quarter acre to a half acre. Once you get larger than that, the definitive answer has to do with how variable it is between your increments across your DU. And that's the statistical answer, because the amount of variability drives how many increments you need. To find that out, you need to do a pilot study with discrete samples that mimic the increments, and then you can calculate how many increments you need. You might have historical data that will help you decide how many increments you need. One of the problems with that in calculating them statistically is the statistics do not recognize area. And obviously, the bigger the area is, the more increments that are needed to create a reasonable density of increments. In a project, it's really a matter of negotiation. At this point, anyway, and until we get more experience, that's about all that I know to say. Bob, do you have anything to add?
No, Dina, I think you covered it. I think perhaps one other or a couple other items to think about, and that is the CSM that sits behind your design, the conceptual site model. And in particular, when you're looking at a particular decision unit or exposure unit, there might be fiscal features that on a certain scale that you want to make sure you capture with increments, which might drive your increment density to make sure that you have sufficient increments to do that. As there might be other considerations that drive it as well. For example, if you are concerned about hotspots or being able to identify them, to make sure you have sufficient increment density to reflect that. So there might be other things that come into play as well.
Okay. Our next question, I think, Bob, also gets passed to you, and this is in reference to your first case study. They ask, was the 25-square-meter hotspot designation defined by MARSIM? If not, how was this area determined?
Yeah, that's a great question. No, it was not. Actually, that was defined by negotiation between Region 4, the state of Kentucky, and the site. They sat down, they talked about it, and basically it was a joint decision that was a reasonable thing to go after.
Okay. This is just a comment that's being directed towards our friends in Hawaii who asked a question about PCB test kits in coralline soils. We do have another participant who has a response for you, and we're going to share that with you by email. But just know that their comment was that we found that the immunoassay-based kits worked well. They had very good success with those in coralline soils, and they have shared their contact info, so we'll be sure to pass that to you in an email so you can follow up with them afterwards. And we thank the participants who supplied that answer. The next question is coming in from Portugal, and they ask, for a sampling approach to be considered as an IMS, wouldn't it be necessary that you used one increment out of each, quote, five increment sample and use it to form five replicates or composites for each decision unit and then calculate the UCL of the results from these composites for each DU?
I think this is going back to Bob's example since they're talking about five increments. So, Bob, I'm going to shift it to you.
Well, yeah, and Jean, could you please repeat that question? Because I'm not sure I completely followed it.
Absolutely. Again, the question coming in from Portugal, and they ask, for a sampling approach to be considered as an IMS, wouldn't it be necessary that you use one increment out of each, quote, five increment sample and use it to form five replicates or composites for each decision unit? Then calculate the UCL of the results from these composites for each DU.
I understand. So I assume that what's being suggested is that to test the hotspot presence absence, we would use potentially a 95% UCL for a 25 square meter area rather than just the straight value gotten from a single composite formed from five increments. That's my interpretation of what's being asked. And I guess the short response is certainly that would give you, that would be more conservative. It would certainly give you more data to work with. The question would be, is it necessary or is it overkill? In this particular case, again, based on retrospective data that we had, the method that was used gave the performance that we were attempting to get. So it behaved and performed the way we wanted it to. Certainly if we had done what was just described, it would have provided more information, possibly have performed better, but certainly would have cost a lot more too. So I guess the short answer is I don't think that that's absolutely necessary in that case. That certainly wasn't the path that we went down.
Okay, thank you. Our next one is a multi-part question, and they actually pose these questions in reference to future workshops or training opportunities. So I'm just going to kind of go through them one by one, and if you guys want to provide a comment, you can. But the first question asks, how do you designate decision units for a typical industrial site?
Well, there's a number of ways you can do it. Going back to the information that was presented about DUs, certainly you can look at source areas differently. Areas where releases may have occurred that serve as secondary sources. And then you probably may want to make fairly small decision units so that cleanup can be as surgical as possible. Otherwise, it would probably be based on exposure units, based on risk assessment, either ecological or human health for workers and such. Bob, do you have anything?
Just two additional thoughts. One is that probably it would likely be driven by what you expected the future use of that facility to be, which in turn would drive your exposure unit definition, which in turn would probably drive the size and the way you might lay them out over the area. But the other thing that I think is more important, and Dean already touched on it, is what you want to try to avoid when you're laying out decision units is a decision unit that cuts up areas that are contaminated in a way that you have a contaminated area that straddles two decision units, and so you miss it. And if the decision unit had just been laid out corresponding to the way the contamination was laid out, you would have caught it and you would have failed that particular area. So I think the decision unit layout, particularly for our industrial facility, really it's tied pretty tightly back to your understanding of the way contamination might have happened, the way it might be distributed laterally, spatially, vertically, and you'd want to make sure that you weren't mismatching your decision units to the reality of the way contamination was at the site.
Okay, great. I know we're coming up on our suggested or planned end time, but we just have a few more questions here in the queue, so we're going to go past 4 p.m. if we need to, just to make sure we can get through the questions that came in. So I'd appreciate everyone if you could hang tight for just a few more minutes. The next question or that comment in that multi-comment submission that came in is in reference to Module 2, where you suggested splitting a one-acre decision unit into four smaller, quote, sampling units, and then collecting composite samples with a minimum number of increments in each SU in order to help alleviate contaminant distribution within the DU as a whole. If you might need this degree resolution, why not split this site into four decision units to begin with and collect 30 incremental samples in each DU?
That could be done if that is what the people involved with the project are comfortable with and are not comfortable with using sampling units. But sort of like Bob said, where if you can attain the performance with less labor and fewer analyses, why wouldn't you do that? The fact is that when you're using sampling units to preserve spatial information about the contamination, you do not need an accurate estimate of the mean. So you don't need to collect the 30 increments from each DU, which would be a sampling unit, but turning it into a decision unit to make it with 30 increments. Bob, do you have anything more to add?
I think it's exactly what you touched on. It's the decision that you're trying to make and how, quote-unquote, confident you need to be that that decision was right. Obviously, if you're going to clear an area for risk purposes, you need to be more confident than if you're just trying to make a yes or no decision about whether your excavation needs to continue. And by the time the excavation is done, then you're going to come back and revisit whether you've met that area from a risk perspective, you know, your goals from a risk perspective or not. So it's how confident you need that decision to be, and then what is the decision you're trying to make? Is it again, trying to clear an exposure unit, or is it carving up a site into smaller decision units to support a remedial design? Completely different decisions, and probably would lead to different layouts of your decision units.
Okay, great. The last comment that they had included with this submission, that they mentioned that they basically use small DUs and good incremental samples versus sampling units and composites on a regular basis to investigate the spatial distribution of contamination at their sites. And if there are no comments on that, then I'll move on to the next question that came in from Boulder, Colorado, and I think this is a pretty important one. And they ask, can we assume that the U.S. EPA supports the use of incremental sampling per the ITRC guidance?
The question seems to assume that U.S. EPA is a monolith. As we all know, it is not. It really depends on the person that you're dealing with, maybe with the region that you're dealing with, as to whether they will support incremental sampling per the ITRC guidance document. Certainly I would hope that they would, but I cannot promise that everybody will.
Okay. And then the next question I have, and I believe it's the last one in the online queue, is coming from Chicago, Illinois. And they state, careful sample preparation as described is labor, equipment, and time intensive. Pardon me. How do, quote, adequate sample prep costs compare to,
similar?
Probably the word is supposed to be similar, 1 to 2.5 gram grabs.
It depends which lab you're working with. I have heard that, doing the good sample processing adds around $100 per sample, but then you're doing a lot fewer samples. Laboratories have told me that obviously as more and more labs
begin gathering the type of equipment they need and become more familiar with it and develop good workflow for processing these samples through, the price is going to come down, plus competition will drive the price down. So I think it's probably under $100 per sample in many places, but probably that's a good number to just be conservative with at this point.
Okay, great. So we are now coming up on 4:04 Eastern, a little bit past our scheduled end time, and we've gone through all of the online questions. So I'm going to provide Dina as well as Bob a chance to make any final comments before I close out the seminar series with slide number 91. Dina?
One of the things that I didn't emphasize a lot in this webinar, and I probably should have, is the fact that not only are you looking for more increments from your field, but you're also looking for a larger mass. The people who have done studies recommend a mass from your DU of about 1 to 2 kilograms. Again, it's this whole idea that larger sample supports are more representative than small sample supports. So when you're doing incremental sampling with your 30 increments or however many increments, it would be good to shoot for around at least 1 kilogram of soil. You can do the trade-off between mass and increments, and that's one way to determine your number of increments, because if you use a larger mass per increment, that also helps control that short-scale heterogeneity that's so detrimental to our results. And I should have emphasized that more, and I didn't.
Bob, any comments or closing statements?
No, just thanks for the opportunity to do this. And it was obvious from the questions that there are some folks out there that have a significant amount of experience with these types of programs already. And I think as time goes on, there's going to that level of experience is going to accumulate. And I suspect there'll be refinements to some of the processes and protocols we talked about today. But in the end, I think it moves us toward a better way of doing characterization work for soils.
Great, thank you. So with that, I'm going to bring everyone to slide number 91, which is the final slide in today's presentation materials. On slide 91, you'll find two links. The first one is a link to the additional resources or links page that's been prepared for today's seminar. Just like with all of the other seminars in the series, on that resources page, you'll be able to download the PowerPoint slides that we covered today, as well as take a look at a wide variety of websites, guidance documents, a variety of other spreadsheets and other things that people can download related to the topic today. And the other link you'll find on slide 91 is our short feedback form. If you'd like to continue to participate in free online training like this through Kluin, please take a minute to fill out that form. We do read each and every one of those responses, so we do thank you in advance for doing that. If you're looking for confirmation of your participation today to earn some sort of credit or track your training, if you fill out the feedback form, you'll have a box you can check to have a confirmation email sent to you for your own records. If you share the line with multiple participants, once you fill out feedback for one person, there's a link that will appear to let another person hop on and submit their own feedback, and they can get their own confirmation record sent to them. So you can actually get records for multiple people under one registration. If you're not sitting at a computer with internet access right now, those links are available on the seminar homepage. Again, you'll see things to buttons on the left side of the screen for links as well as feedback, as well as at the bottom. So those are open indefinitely. You can come back and replay or access them at any time. The final thing is, again, we did record today's session. You will automatically receive an email as soon as this archive, as well as the others in the series, are available. If you don't want to wait, you can certainly go to kluin.org/training, and you can click on the link to the archive page and browse the over 400 seminars that we already have available for free download and replay. So I want to extend my thanks again to both Dina and Bob for taking the time to convert this day-long training into a seminar series on Kluin. I want to thank the we had about 400 people live for each event, so that's about 1,200 attendees across the whole seminar series. So we appreciate everybody taking time to participate. And again, I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. Again, if you're looking for more training, please come back to CLUIN and take a look at our training calendar, and I hope to either see you or hear from you soon on a future CLUIN seminar. This is the formal conclusion for today's seminar. I hope you have a great rest of your day.